Welcome to the 121st episode of Reverse Sweat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
It's 81 years to the day that the timeless test began. England and South Africa fought it out over 11 days before England had to leave to get their ship in Cape Town. Welcome to the podcast that tries never to drag on.
I love the idea of the ending of your cricket match being defined by the shipping timetables. Bring back that era, I say. In this episode, we are going to be talking about the recent New Zealand-India Test Series, or the ongoing New Zealand-India Test Series. We're going to be talking about a remarkable World Cup game when Kenya did a bit of giant toppling. And we are going to be reviewing Crossing the Line, Gideon Haigh's account of how Australian cricket lost its way. Andy, to kick off, you have been thinking about something that I think has been all on all of our minds, which is international travel in these corona-stricken days, and particularly about cricket tourism.
Well, this goes back to last summer where, you know, we were all in Ben Stokes' Wonderland and weren't thinking about coronavirus, etc. And the ICC have just published a report, which, you know, is obviously a thrilling start to any podcast item.
Yes. The
headline item was to say that the UK economy benefited to the tune of £350 million from last summer's World Cup. So this is including, you know, benefit to business, hotels, etc., etc. And it seems like with the bidding cycle beginning for ICC events post-2023, this is an attempt from the ICC to prod countries to have a go and host. The bit that caught my eye, though, was the section on cricket tourism. I'll quote very briefly. The rise of cricket tourism is clearly demonstrated with almost 20% of the World Cup's attendees coming from overseas and a total of 85% of ticket buyers coming from out of town. We expect this trend to continue to rise as the Asian subcontinent continues rapid economic growth. Now, we hear an awful lot about the influence of particularly India's growing wealth on the future of the game. But this is quite a different angle, and I must admit, one that I've never really thought about before. I think traditionally, I guess the historically wealthier nations, you'd see English fans, Australian fans travel abroad in numbers. But as this report makes clear, we're likely to see more and more, particularly Indian fans and other fans from the subcontinent, travelling in numbers. And I thought that's rather an exciting thought. I think it'll mean interesting things for atmospheres across grounds against the world. And I think it also will mean something quite interesting for those quite fun ad hoc meetings between cricket fans, those sort of cross-cultural encounters. So yes, an interesting trend that I hadn't considered.
It is, and it's also an interesting counterpoint to the figures that are often bandied around TV rights. Because often when you think about where the massive revenue comes for big tournaments, it's in those huge bids that happen for the TV rights, particularly for, you know, I've remember actually in the Gideon Haigh book that we're reading at the moment, the figure that he talks about, which I think is $1,000 million for the TV rights for one of the IPL series, which actually isn't too far away from £350 million in terms of the revenue that comes out of, you know, the bums on seats rather than bums on the couch, to coin a phrase. So I have to say it's not actually something that I'd really thought about of cricket being a big tourism driver in that way.
Well, I think this is something that people pay more and more attention to, because particularly the Olympics has come under a lot of scrutiny because of this thing that it costs so much to host that people really weigh up the benefits. I think cricket is obviously a little different, because if you've got the stadiums to start with, you're hopefully
no one's building new stadiums for cricket.
Exactly, you're not embarking on this huge sort of infrastructure project.
The other question is the extent to which people want to travel to different countries as well. Because I know that, for instance, when there are some real kind of destination touring places. So when England tour Sri Lanka, I think they bring a big, big crowd with them, because there are lots of people who think, oh, that would be a nice opportunity to go and see Sri Lanka latterly. Whereas, of course, 15 years ago when the Civil War was happening, there was very little touring that was associated with that. However, when, for instance, there's a tour to Bangladesh or a tournament in Bangladesh, then the level of tourism that goes alongside that is much less. And so maybe the UK was benefiting there from a bit of an increase in sort of general popularity from people, particularly in the subcontinent, wanting to go to London for their holiday.
Yeah, I mean, there's exactly that. And there's also this thing that I guess we're still going to learn over the next few years about preference for formats. You know, do Indian fans, for example, are they going to be as willing to travel to for a test series as they would for a World Cup.
Yep.
Some Indian fans, I hope, will have made the journey down to New Zealand for a thrilling series, even though possibly not pleasurable for one to watch from an Indian perspective.
Yeah, and do you know what? New Zealand is somewhere I would love to go and watch a test tour.
Oh, the grounds. Beautiful little grounds. How beautiful are those grounds? Those grass verges. Oh, no, they're all wonderful.
Yeah, take your picnic blanket. But it has not been all picnics for the Indian team, as you have alluded to. So it was quite fascinating, actually, to watch New Zealand run through India. And New Zealand have now got to the stage where, at home, they are a really, really formidable side. And one of the reasons for that, which actually came as a bit of a surprise to me, was a stat about their opening bowling partnership, or their sort of preferred opening bowling partnership of the last few years between Trent Bolt and Tim Southee, which is now the third most successful opening bowling partnership in Test cricket in terms of wickets taken. So behind only James Anderson and Stuart Broad, who are at number one, and then Wasim Akram and Waqar Yunus, who are at number two, and those are two pretty formidable opening pairs to be following. And the Southee Bolt partnership have taken 246 wickets at an average of 26.51 runs. Does that come as a surprise to you? Because I saw that and I suddenly thought, wow, I hadn't even really thought of that as being a, you know, obviously they've had a lot of success as a partnership, but I hadn't really thought of it as being a kind of great partnership for the ages. Does that take you as a surprise?
It does, because I think I'd rate them very highly. But, I mean, the other thing they've got really against them, as all of the New Zealand team do, is they just don't get enough opportunities. So to have racked up that record, having played less Test cricket. Worth noting as well, Southee's 31, Trent Bolt is 30. They've got plenty of time to build on this.
They really do. They really do. And you watch them, you watch what their real kind of key to success is, which is fundamentally their ability to move the ball both ways. It's not that either of them have blistering pace, it's just that they do have that accuracy and that constant ability to move the ball in a lot of conditions, particularly in home conditions, and that is something that's quite sustainable as they, you know, as they get a bit older into their 30s. So it'll be really interesting to see where that goes over the years. But I thought a great kind of testimony to the to that kind of quiet achiever status that the Kiwis have, that suddenly here you go, they're world beaters, they're beating India, they're the third greatest opening partnership of all time in terms of bowling.
And fascinating, I think, what it means for India. I mean, Virat Kohli, one thing I think we maybe don't always give him enough credit for, I mean, we all recognise he's a wonderful player, but his commitment to Test cricket, both as a player and also in all his public statements, I think has been huge. You know, it's partly why India continues to take the Test game so seriously. But I think the result in New Zealand represents it represents a major obstacle to this India's team kind of claims at greatness. You know, that ability. I know all teams, Test teams, are finding it increasingly hard to win away from home. And, you know, we certainly wouldn't be betting on New Zealand in the reverse fixture. But yes, it poses a really interesting question to see whether that Indian side and whether Kohli in particular can come again in those conditions.
And you do point, I think, put your finger on something really interesting there, is that increasingly I think we are getting to a stage where teams are harder to beat at home and finding it harder to win away from home than perhaps they ever have. And you look at the difference between a Test series in India and a Test series in New Zealand and what it takes to win either one, and that difference is just getting wider and wider apart.
From the archives, and in this episode, Toby is going to take us back to the 1996 World Cup and when the Minnows of Kenya took on the might of the West Indies.
So this 96 World Cup was generating publicity even before it started. It was hosted in India, Pakistan and Sri Lanka. And because of security fears in Sri Lanka, several of the games there were cancelled. The upshot of which was that the Sri Lankans, who automatically by default won those games that were cancelled, were guaranteed a quarterfinal berth before the tournament even started. The other angle was that it was the first ever World Cup tournament to include three non-test playing nations, or what we now call the Minnows. And those were Kenya, the Netherlands and the United Arab Emirates, who had all qualified via the 1994 ICC trophy. And there was a real sense as this started that these teams were really going to be the whipping boys of the tournament. And whilst in the first few games of the tournament they put up some valiant performances, they did indeed always end up on the losing side. So Kenya lost by 7 wickets to India. The UAE were beaten by 169 runs by South Africa. Ultimately, the Netherlands ran England relatively close. They lost by just 49 runs. But it seemed like the writing was on the wall. This was a great opportunity to give some exposure to these countries and these teams. But they were going to finish at the bottom of each of the tables.
You slightly feel that's England playing their traditional role in a most major yes. tournaments in most sports by yep. getting themselves into trouble against a weaker side who they really, really should beat.
We have a proud tradition of doing that. Kenya had been, as I said, had been thrashed by India. They'd been thrashed by Australia. They'd lost to Zimbabwe, not particularly thrilling Zimbabwe side by 5 wickets. And so when they come to meet the West Indies in Pune on the 29th of February, the game sort of feels a bit inevitable. This West Indies side, it's a bit of an end of an era side. It's got some very strong names in it. Richie Richardson, Brian Lara, Shiv Chandrapal, Jimmy Adams, Ian Bishop, Curtly Ambrose, Courtney Walsh. It's a team full of superstars. And whilst they've come into the tournament in a bit of disarray, typical of the West Indies, a lot of rumours about falling out in the dressing room, a lot of players who, as I say, were kind of at the end of their careers. The simple fact is that they're playing here in this Kenya game against a bunch of amateurs, and the odds on a Kenya victory are 500-1. So the West Indies, they win the toss, and they, I think, see an opportunity to get this, game done and dusted nice and early, as you do in a long tournament, and they put Kenya into bat. Things sort of follow the script, and Kenya reach 81-6. But this is despite the West Indies kind of not really turning up when it comes to their fielding. There are several dropped catches and a remarkable 27 runs in wides and no balls. So
that
almost half
a level
of the runs.
Of complacency, doesn't it? I mean, you think to bowl that many wides against an opposition where, frankly, you're not having to strain for every last inch of pace. That's a figure that would alarm you as a coach and suggest that your team might not be fully on it that day.
Yes, and I think remember that word complacency. It's one that kind of is key to this story as it develops. So from 81-6, Kenya kind of salvage a little bit of scoreboard decency. They do at least get past 150 thanks to a 7. Past 100 and then 150 thanks to a 7th wicket partnership of 40 between Hitesh Modi and Thomas Adoyo. Thomas Adoyo going on to have a relatively considerable career, at that time just 17 years old, and incidentally being the youngest player in the tournament. The final total is 166. You have to remember this is 1996, where the one day scores weren't uniformly huge, pitches weren't as good, batsmen didn't sort of tee off as much. So 166 is, it's not a totally humiliating score, but it's certainly well short of defendable against a West Indies side that has this this lineup. When you think of Richardson, Lara, Chandrapal, Adams in their batting lineup. So it's really here that the match gets a bit strange. You talked a bit about the West Indies sort of attitude. And another odd thing is that during the innings break, Wes Hall, who's the West Indies manager, spends apparently the entire interval between the innings remonstrating with the officials about a run out that he thought shouldn't have been a run out. And you think this is a bit weird when you're playing a team with a bunch of amateurs who have only put 166 on the board. Does your energy really need to go into disputing a run-out decision during the game? But anyway, for Wes Hall, he's particularly incensed about this. And when the West Indies come out, they lose 2 wickets very quickly at the top of the order before Brian Lara comes to the wicket. Now, Lara plays, in these circumstances, a truly bizarre innings. He comes out, as one journalist puts it, like a man playing in a benefit match, swishing at everything and generally missing. And it's actually only a couple of overs after he comes to the wicket that Wes Hall sends the 12th man out to tell Lara to basically to calm down. You just need to play a decent innings and you'll win the game for us. Soon after that, a couple of balls later, Lara attempts a mad single, and if the throw had been anywhere near the stumps, he'd have been run out. But it says something, I think, about his state of mind here.
It's really curious, because that actually sounds like something different to complacency. I mean, I guess it could be, but the idea panic? That you would just come... Yeah, I mean, maybe there is. I mean, there is... I think it's obviously well documented when you see a cricket team collapse. You know, these things are a bit infectious, and maybe there's a particular terror at the prospect of the humiliation of losing to someone, losing to a team considered much below you. Mm-hmm. But really odd for a batsman like Lara, who... I mean, part of his greatness was this idea of being really unflustered in various yes. situations. No, really, really strange. You wonder if perhaps we're talking about, a dressing room that just was not entirely happy. I mean, as you said, you've got Wes Hall behaving strangely, clearly yep. angry and riled. Maybe Lara himself, not quite himself either.
So the other character that I want to introduce into the narrative here is the Kenyan wicketkeeper Tariq Iqbal. Iqbal was a cricketer who, frankly, was renowned for his incompetence. It's a wonderful quote from The Guardian who said that he was, quote, bearded and bespectacled, wearing a blue headband and a double chin. You know, this is the age of amateurs, after all. And Iqbal in this game had dropped so many balls, not necessarily catches, just balls coming through to the keeper, that his own bowlers just started laughing at him halfway through the Windies innings, which is never something that's totally reassuring, I imagine. So when a couple of overs later Lara does edge one through to the keeper, his assumption, everyone's assumption, is that he's going to get away with it. You know, Iqbal can't even catch something that isn't an edge. How is he going to catch this? And I'm going to quote The Telegraph now in their description of this moment, because it's brilliant. The Telegraph journalist said, "The ball sank somewhere into Iqbal's nether regions and the gloves clutched desperately trying to locate it. Then, glory be, it reappeared in his hands and was raised aloft in triumph and relief." And I dare say there was a bit of kind of disbelief there. You can just, picture this moment where the ball just disappears. No one knows where it is. Has it gone into the boundary? Has he caught it? Has it caught somewhere on his body? But he has, in fact, taken the wicket of Brian Lara. And it's the wicket that the Kenyans desperately want. The Kenyan coach, a former India Test player, talking after the game, said that their only hope of winning was to get Lara early. And then tellingly, he also says, and you could say he contributed to that end by the way that he played. And so here we are in a situation where Kenyans have scored have made a low score, and now they have managed to get Lara out. They're on a high after this, the Kenyans, and the rest of the batting just absolutely crumbles. So Odumbu's spin takes 3 for 15 off 10 overs. I mean, that's incredible figures. And again, going to what you were saying, it appears that when facing spin particularly, the West Indies' minds were just totally scrambled. They just didn't know what to do. And they were all out for 93, meaning that it was a 73-run defeat in this game.
And Odumbu was a player who, as you said earlier with Adoya, Odumbu was a player who did go on to actually have a pretty creditable yep. career for Kenya. So yes, this marks the beginning, I guess, of a Kenyan generation that was to have its moments as well.
And it marks the beginning of the end for this West Indies team. Really, this was one of the moments that really said, okay, this is the end of a great team. And it sort of foreshadowed some of the trials and tribulations that the Windies would have over the coming, decades, continuing to the present day, I think. So the West Indies media really identified this as the death knell for the team, and certainly the leadership. It was Richie Richardson's last year in the job as captain. I think this is quite telling. Prime Minister Edison James of Dominica said that the state of the team had to be treated as a pressing national issue. But none of this, obviously, could dampen the spirits of the Kenyans, who were kind of beautifully honest afterwards by saying, as with many cricketers at that time, the West Indies have absolutely been our heroes and idols, the people we idolise, the people who have really got us into the game. So suddenly beating them in a World Cup is a dream come true. Interestingly, the West Indies went on to actually have an interesting tournament. They beat a strong Australia team quite convincingly. Brian Lara made a beautiful century, which again puts his innings here into sharp relief, because he wasn't out of form. They then meet the Australians again in the quarterfinals and have one of the great chokes in the history of cricket. There's a From the Archives feature on this, I think, where they throw away a totally unassailable position to lose. Business as usual is also resumed when Kenya get absolutely thrashed by Sri Lanka and don't make it past the quarterfinals. I think the longer term effects on this was that despite all of the issues within the West Indies team, there was an assumption that they would soundly beat Kenya, the non-test playing side with no heritage, a bunch of amateurs. But in the future, after this game, I think all teams were on notice that it would be a mistake to take a victory against the Minnows for granted, particularly in this shorter form of the game.
And I think this is why these arguments about who should and shouldn't be in these major tournaments are often so emotive, because I think we all know the challenges of developing a country to the point where they can compete consistently at the top level. But it's days like this and games like this that inspire a nation and that also just provide entertainment that we're still talking about, you know, 25 years later.
The review, and we have been reading for this episode Gideon Haigh's book Crossing the Line: How Australian Cricket Lost Its Way, published in 2018 in the wake of the Cape Town sandpaper gate incident.
So Haigh describes Crossing the Line as his own cultural review into Australian cricket. He says it's less official and far cheaper than Cricket Australia's, but genuinely independent. He spoke to 50 men and women in cricket whose opinions I respect, players, coaches, officials and observers past and present. And I think he sums it up very neatly where he says Crossing the Line originates in a simple idea that nobody goes to sleep honest and wakes up a cheat. So this is about looking back into the culture of Australian cricket and how we got to those events in Cape Town. Now, we, I think, as a podcast, could very happily do a spin-off where every episode we just review another Gideon Haigh book. He is that wonderful a writer, and he's also that prolific a writer. But this is a very different beast, actually, to anything we've really read before, because although Haigh traditionally has a real interest in how the game's administered, this is truly this book's focus. It really is looking into the nuts and bolts of how the game works. Having got into that, and having got into that level of detail, do you think, Toby, that you did it reveal something to you? Did you think you walked away with it with a better understanding of how Australian cricket culture evolved?
Definitely. And, you know, there's, I suppose, if you were to propose the idea of a book on the mechanics of cricket administration, would I find that necessarily the most enthralling topic? Probably not. I think one of the kind of saving graces, that sounds like damning with faint praise, and it's not meant like that, but one of the remarkable things about this book is that you can kind of read it in a couple of sittings. I certainly did. I read the majority of it in a single plane journey. It's from a series called Sports Shorts, which is fundamentally a series of essays that covers different topics in sport. It's about 180 pages long. And one of the nice things about it, I think, and this is something that Gideon Haigh is quite well placed to be able to do because of the trust that we have in him and because of the breadth of his interests, is he moves very rapidly between a whole lot of areas. So one minute he might be talking about kind of management theory and a particular management theory study that's been put out somewhere. Another moment he might be talking about, you know, details of cricket history and what the Australian cricketing setup looked like at the beginning of the 20th century. Then he might be analysing kind of a key moment on the pitch or the character of individual players. So one thing that I thought was really fascinating was the way that he weaved together all of these kind of different narratives to build up an overarching picture of the Australian cricket as a whole. Were there kind of particular elements that came as a surprise to you in terms of learning things about the Australian cricketing establishment? I suppose particularly in the light of having read and reviewed on this podcast the Jeff Lemon book on the same topic, looking into the kind of lead up to the Cape Town incident.
So that was my worry reading this, was I thought the Lemon book was so wonderful, and I thought, is there anything more to add? But it's a really very different approach. And I think one thing I was convinced by reading this was that, I sometimes find it quite hard to force myself to read about, the latest goings on at the ECB, for example. But this book really reminded me that it matters, and it matters if you care about the sport, because it affects the game the whole way up. And I think that's one thing that really comes across from this. It affects the perception of the lowest club cricketer to the highest test player.
Yep.
And I think whereas Lemon's book was very much focused on the dressing room and how that culture got out of hand, this is much more focused on how a Cricket Australia culture that was taken over to some extent by people who were focused on growing the game, which is absolutely their job as administrators, and somehow in the process lost sight of quite a few of the fundamentals.
Yep. I mean, a couple of examples of that for me is this kind of obsession that we see along the journey from Cricket Australia to creating stars.
Mm.
This idea that to create really strong cricket, you need to create more, more Bradmans, more household names. And what the actual effect and impact of that has been on the structure of the game and on cricketers and on the quality of cricket as a whole. The fact that the Futures League, which was an idea that originated in the 90s, I think, where basically clubs could only field a certain number of players over the age of 23, with the idea that you would then develop young talent. And what it did was it forced a whole lot of really, really good cricketers to retire, because they suddenly didn't have, they weren't necessarily playing in their, in Sheffield Shield sides, but they had nowhere else to play quality cricket anymore. And how impoverished cricket becomes when you suddenly say, we are going to abandon all of the, and there's a wonderful moment where Haig talks about the difference between, how the pursuit of the excellent can basically rid the game of the very good. And ditto with the Victorian Sheffield Shield game, which didn't produce many test players, but just raised the overall standard of cricket because it was a great side to have in domestic cricket. And yet that being totally discounted by the establishment because, there weren't people, Steve Smith didn't come out of that side,
yeah,
for instance.
I mean, I think it's also fascinating how these debates do get played over again and again, and you realise that, as ever, the answer is often a muddy compromise in between. I mean, obviously, lots of test teams have had success by gambling on potential. I sometimes think, someone like Alistair Cook, who I think, had not had to serve many, many years in county cricket, but people saw his ability. But I think it was absolutely your point that by going too far down that, you alienated a huge number of Australian cricketers who, frankly, were good enough and felt,
yep,
they'd just been discarded.
Yep.
I thought there was an awful lot here about the way administrators' good intentions go wrong. And I thought it was really interesting the effort. There was an obsession with tracking players. So
yes,
apparently this was taken a lot from the All Blacks, which I didn't know, but apparently they're very big on this and have obviously had success. But I thought it was very telling that one of the metrics that the players, alongside physical performance, was to do with mental health. But one of the point was made by some of the people Haig interviewed was that you got told off if you hadn't filled this thing in, even though the reason you hadn't filled this thing in was because you were suffering from depression. There was,
yeah,
no help given to you. And,
yeah,
then someone else makes the point that, the way players were dropped was absolutely brutal. So the idea, the idea that tracking actually equated to any sort of genuine concern. And I think it was just another one of these examples. You think, you go, you come up with the innovation without really thinking through what it actually kind of means more deeply.
One of the things I think that reveals is the place where management meets, management theory and management speak and managers who know nothing about cricket meets the game of cricket. And what that balance is, I think, is a question throughout the game, because Haig is someone who is very interested in management in and of itself and how businesses run, and isn't one of these people who says, oh, it's just all about, making sure that you have oil on your bat. You need to make sure that these organizations are able to run themselves properly and provide a bedrock of the game. But it is a constant tension, I think, that Haig reveals, between people who actually know and love the game and people who want to run it as a business as well, actually.
And I think this you get this feeling that forever, as with in England, we're finding it, you end up in this cycle, don't you, where the sort of administrators take the game in one direction and then gets pushed back and you sort of have to, and I think maybe that tension is kind of an inevitable one, and perhaps it's always been like that.
Yep.
I think there's also this issue of overreacting sometimes. So I think there was a really interesting point made around the Ashes defeat, and I'm going to get the year wrong, I think in the winter of 2011, where England went and sort of routed Australia. And Haig makes the argument that, you know, this wasn't really necessarily indicative of like an utter crisis in Australian cricket. It was basically a transition point. They'd lost
England
generation.
Were great and Australia were bad. Yeah.
England were great. That Australia had lost a few players. They also had a few injuries. And they got beaten. And it did make me think of another thing. This, you know, this gut instinct we often have to, you know, suffer a defeat, particularly in the Ashes, and treat that as a reason to kind of tear everything up and start again, is also something that I think administrators from time to time have to be brave enough to mitigate against.
Yep.
There is less, as we touched on here, there is less here on culture than in the Lemon Book. But I think it's still very good on that. And I think several of the key actors do not come out well. I think Darren Layman in particular.
Yes.
You struggle to see, frankly, you know, people are very critical of him as a coach. And his various pronouncements on the Australian way, including exhorting players to be aggressive in everything you do. You just really wonder what's being added here that goes beyond the slogan. You know, you think surely the top coaching is a sort of clever, subtle, you know, reactive thing depending on players' individual needs. And this feels a rather long way from that.
Yeah, and there is a nice description of the way that this kind of mantra about what it means to be an Australian cricketer is developed within the team, and how you have some people, you know, previously kind of mild-mannered, well-behaved people turning towards a kind of default attitude of aggression through this kind of sudden cult of the Australian way of needing to be aggressive in everything. And I mean, Haig is one of the kind of great wordsmiths of the game, and there are so many kind of beautiful turns of phrase in this book. One that I really love, which I just thought was a kind of brilliant put down, was when Matthew Wade was brought into the side, and Haig's analysis of that is that it was actually less for his abilities as a player and more because management saw him typifying this Australian way, this ability to, you know, get under the skin of the opposition and stuff. And Haig describes him as, quotes, inconsistent with the gloves, but consistent with his pugnacity, which I think is a great summary of situation and the player.
It's a wonderful passage, and it does show how far things had got out of control, because I think they make the point that Peter Neville, who I must admit I'd rather forgotten about, but, you know, had done a totally competent job with both gloves and bat, was discarded. But it actually made me think back to this summer's Ashes, where you might remember there was a wonderful spell in the final test between Archer and Wade, and they were going at each other, and it was quite something. And it made me feel a bit guilty, because it suddenly made me realise that this Australian way, this aggression, you know, sometimes I've bought into that. You know, sometimes I've been the beneficiary when I've enjoyed, you know, Wade and Archer going at it. So, yes, perhaps we've all at times bought into this in various ways. So that was Gideon Haig crossing the line. I think this is an incident that is quite rare, Sandpaper Gate, in that within a very short time after the book, after the incident, we've had some really high quality writing come out on it, both from Jeff Lemon and from Gideon Haig. And I think that says a lot for how much it meant to the game, for how much it felt like a real seismic turning point.